Good morning and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday Special. You're lucky enough to join us on the 40th Sunday Special, which marks a big milestone for us. And it's hard to believe we've been doing this all year, Tony.
It's great, and it's also terrible when you think 40 weeks of doing it online live. It just shows you where the world has gone. But we're all supposed to be optimistic this week, Martin. Did you not get the memo? We're all happy now.
I feel hopeful. I hope everybody else feels a little more hopeful. It seems there's some light coming at the end of the tunnel. We'll keep our fingers crossed. Just to remind everybody, you know, we do these podcasts and we put out all kinds of things. And there are so many podcasts now on the platform. The diversity is huge. There is something there for everybody. So tell your friends. Patreon.com/Tortoise Shack. And that's how you become a patron. I'd like to introduce our guests this morning. We have Noel Brown, we have Dawn Foster, we have Emma D'Souza, and of course we have, Tony Groves as well. To start the conversation, I think we'll go to Noel first. Noel, you are going to talk to us about what the Gardaí have said in relation to the Mother and Baby Homes report, and that if anybody has any information of a crime being committed, that they should come forward. Does that strike you as strange at this late stage in the day?
Yeah, I have real trouble understanding it, to be quite honest. I don't really get what is happening with this. All I know is that it seems like more shifting it away from, you know, the real issues of what's going on here. Also, I feel to ask survivors again to share their stories. We shared our stories to the Commission of Investigation, and the report was a disaster in terms of how our testimonies, how our stories were treated. But to expect people to rock up to the guards and, you know, talk about their stories again, it's very strange. And it seems to me like some sort of smoke and mirrors exercise to get away from the fact that the report, you know, the commission was such a bad report. The government haven't acknowledged how deeply offensive it was in all its forms. The legislation that was promised around the right to our identity, our birth certificates, medical information, birth information hasn't happened. That's been delayed. And it just seems to be a continuous process of delay, delay, delay. And this seems to be another shifting of the blame, shifting of, you know, preventing anything from happening, any real action. I mean, I was on with you a while back. I'm on again talking about the same issues. Nothing has changed. And I think what needs to be acknowledged here as well is the emotional fallout for survivors after that commission investigation report was colossal across the entire country. And there are no support services there for people. No support, particularly in Cork, which has Besborough Mother and Baby Home. The revelations there created a huge emotional fallout for people. And there's no qualified people to help with, you know, people working in the area of this issue. There's nobody there. The Commission of Investigation had, I think it was 21 million at their disposal. That's 11.5 lakh left. So maybe they should think about directing that funding towards dealing and helping people who were affected by this issue. And also in the midst of all this, to ask people to go to a Garda station and talk about their stories again and again and try and get justice. To me, it's another paper exercise. How long will this take? It's a delaying, delaying, delaying tactic. And nobody is following through on the promises that were made. And I just think it's deeply disturbing, the whole thing. I really do. I don't understand where it's coming from.
There were a couple of things, Noella. It's fair to say there was talk of enhanced medical cards and supports coming out of the report. But it was you who educated us, obviously, in our dealings with on the report and what was to come. And you had pointed out that the report pretty much delivered what it was set out to do, because, you know, when Enda Kenny first spoke about initiating it, it was going to be kind of one of these, should we did this to ourselves kind of thing. And you know, so the parameters, the criteria were almost defined before the outset. But in terms of the re-traumatization of people, the intergenerational hurt that we're seeing here now, and then asking people, as you said, to relive their stories yet again, a couple of things stand out to me. Are you any further on in, say, for example, vaccine trials? Has there been any clarity on whether you know, you or your people, the other, I hate using that word survivors, but other people have gone through the, come through the mother and baby homes. Are we any further along in terms of vaccine trials and the knowledge of what happened to people? Or is this still this just big generic, oh, it happened, but we can't say who or where?
Yeah, same thing. You know, there's no acknowledgement there. And that's been a huge issue for a very long time. I think one of the things that was in the report, you know, apart from saying that there was no evidence of incarceration, no evidence of forced adoption, the other thing was no evidence of injuries to children who were the subject of vaccine trials. I think they're acknowledging that it happened, but they're refusing to do anything about it. I asked the Commission of Investigation to investigate on my behalf whether I was a subject of vaccine trials, and they refused. And that's a lot of people's experiences. It's just, there are so many issues here that are not being dealt with. We have illegal adoptions as well. We have the vaccine trials, and nothing is actually being done. And no, the harm is not being dealt with, and the emotional fallout is not being dealt with. So we're in this same waiting. Even our, like I did a subject access request, like so many people, prompted by the Department of Children. And with that's delayed now as well, because of the complexity of responding to the request is what they've said to people. It's not that complex. Give us our information, acknowledge the harm that was done, and stop pushing it away and hiding it and, you know, delaying tactics. And that's what's going on. And exactly the same as the last time I spoke to you. And this is years upon years upon years. We waited 5 years for the report. It was a disaster on so many levels and so deeply offensive to survivors. And nothing is happening. Again, nothing is happening.
And you already made statements to the commission. Mm-hmm. And they tried to destroy the statements. But is there not a case that the Gardaí should have been in on this from the very beginning?
Absolutely.
You know, the Gardaí, why weren't the Gardaí actually present when people were giving their statements? The whole thing stinks, Noelle.
Yeah, it does. And it's deeply offensive and hurtful to people. And I just can't believe in 2021, you know what I mean, that such a large minority in Ireland are subjected to this treatment. There isn't a family in Ireland that isn't affected by this issue or doesn't know someone who's affected by this issue. And the government really needs to acknowledge that and do something about it and acknowledge that it's not about blaming society in it, you know, as an answer to this, to acknowledge the collusion between the church and the state and to make sure that reparation is made and an acknowledgement that it happened. Because the longer it goes on, there's the sense for survivors we're not believed. There was a talk of contaminated evidence in the report because we might have spoken to each other. I mean, it's unbelievable the way people are being treated. It is a violation of our human rights on so many levels. And it is a re-traumatizing of people. And it has to end. And this, you know, we've had 5 years of delay, as I said, of the report. This delaying again. There is criminal, you know, there should be criminal investigations. 9,000 babies died in this country and thousands of them are missing. They're in mass graves that we know of. At least we know that they're in Sean Ross Abbey. We know they're in Besborough. We know they're in Tuam. That's criminal investigation. If they want the guards to do something, let them start with that and acknowledge that these crimes happened. 9,000 babies and children in this country died at the hands of the church and the state. And that needs to be acknowledged. It's a very dark 76-year history of institutional abuse and lack of care of its citizens. And the legacy that it has left people like me is beyond belief. And we shouldn't have to deal with it. And the level of horror that is out there that people are dealing with on a daily basis has to end, because we cannot embrace ourselves and call ourselves a new Ireland. We have repeal, we have marriage equality. And this glaring human rights issue is being passed off. And it's like the government and the church still are attacking a very vulnerable minority in this country. And it's a disgrace. It really is.
Dawn, are you aware of this in Ireland and what's been going on with the mother and baby's homes and the report?
Yes, I've been following it a fair amount. And I mean, one thing that Noelle said that really struck me was the idea of contamination. And, you know, I know that the report was a complete whitewash. It was completely terrible. You know, it was particularly pathetic that they asked so many women to come forward with you know, evidence for the report, and then nothing came out of it. But one thing that Noelle said that really, really struck me was the idea of contamination of evidence. So the fact that essentially the state didn't give any support to people who needed it. And then when you have, you know, the so-called temerity to speak to other people who've been through the same thing, you're accused of, you know, essentially contaminating evidence. So you know, there isn't any state support. When you actually speak to people who've also been through it to try and get through it yourself, the state then turn around and say, well, you know, now that you've spoken to other people, say you joined a support group, say you've even spoken to, you know, other neighbours and people in your community who've been through it, you know, you're essentially told that the state won't help you and that any report that they put into it won't help it. And, you know, obviously when it comes to reports and inquiries, I mean, there isn't really much precedent in Britain for anything coming out of it. You know, look at the Iraq inquiry. The only report I can think of that anything came out of was probably the BSE inquiry, and that's because it involved, you know, farmers and dead cows. But that idea of contamination of evidence was, you know, was really, really key. And I thought that, you know, I was really, really surprised by, you know, how well Noelle spoke about that.
Emma, there is some moves afoot up north for some sort of inquiry, but the perimeters seem to be better set than what happened down here. There seems to be more interest in getting to the truth. Any kind of timeline emerging on that?
Well, I'm not aware of the specific timeline on it, but there does seem to be better parameters being put in place. I mean, the report that came out in the South was incredibly disappointing. In particular, I think about Catherine Connolly's statement in the House and her response to it, and just the fact that, as Noelle has said, you know, people have been expected to come forward and relive that trauma. It does appear to be just another, you know, exercise and paper that will delay progress. So I think it is really disappointing. In terms of the North, I'm hoping that they are going to, you know, maybe handle this investigation better. And it's always something that sort of has almost felt quite close to home for ourselves, because a few years ago, my grandmother informed me that the priest came to Urdor to try and get my mum, when she was pregnant with me, to go into a mother and baby home, and she said no. But so I always find that conversations around it be quite emotive in that sense, because it was also close to her own family.
Noelle, is there anything that could emerge from the North that you think could help the people who in the South?
Well, the interim report that came out recently, I read through that, and one of the really, really positives around the Northern Ireland report is the way they dealt with survivors, the duty of care that they had that was not present in our report. People were given their transcripts to make sure that they were happy with what was going to be published. We had none of that. We never saw our transcripts. We're still asking for them. And they actually didn't, it appears they didn't make transcripts for the confidential committee at all. They did recordings, which they then lost and then magically found again. So I think the duty of care that they had around the Northern Ireland report was very, very heartening. And I think they spoke to people, people who would have experience of working with survivors of institutions. They made it very clear that it was survivor-centred approach, which was completely absent from the Commission of Investigation. So I would certainly see a more positive outcome from the Northern Ireland report.
Thanks very much for that, Noelle. We're going to move on a bit.
Can I just make one comment on it? Just in the week that it was, a few days ago, we did a podcast with Dara Mackin, who's representing the survivors and the families from the Stardust, the 48 who never came home. And they're still facing the same sort of thing, where they can't even get access to the legal aid that the state put aside to actually seek justice. So it is, again, defer, deny, defer, deny. I mean, again, I'm quoting Noel here. I've learned all of this from you, unfortunately, about the obfuscation of the state. And when you see it happening in so many different ways, different avenues, but it's the same pattern, and it's the same pattern of that. And it's just very disheartening to watch it. And we really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this, because we know you want to be talking about the arts and about the things you're writing, the next.
Absolutely. You know,
so that's what we want to be talking to you about, but we have to continue to do this, unfortunately. I am going to go to Emma next, because the last time we spoke, Emma, it was a few Sundays ago, and we were talking about issues as there was riots on the streets of Belfast, and there had been a petrol bomb thrown at a bus, and we had seen, you know, calls for that echoed the events of not too long, not the too distant past, and we could hear the same sort of phraseology emerging. Since then, there's been some calm, but there's also been huge political upheaval. Do you want to give us your synopsis of the last few weeks and where we actually stand at the moment?
Oh, well, there might not be enough time to run through what has been a mad week in politics in Northern Ireland. So in terms of the last time we were talking, we were discussing the eruption of violence and riots in primarily working class areas. You know, that does seem to have been quelled over the last few weeks. But disappointingly, a lot of the issues that these riots highlighted in terms of the influence of paramilitary organizations in these areas, the lack of investment, the social economic issues, they're not being addressed. So it's really only a matter of time before we see perhaps another outbreak in these areas, because until you address the underlying causes, you know, it's not going to be remedied. And then on top of all that, we have the political instability that is pretty prevalent here at the moment, with First Minister Arlene Foster being subjected to quite a quick coup in the end, in that 85% of DUP MLAs and MPs signed a letter of no confidence in her. And within 24 hours of her saying that, they were just rumors and not to worry about it, she was giving in her resignation. So it was very fast in the end for Arlene Foster. But unsurprising for many to see that she really has taken the fall for the last few years. Many of us thought it would have been RHI, but it seems the final straw that broke the camel's back was in fact the fact that she abstained from a vote on banning conversion therapy and has been seen by some within the DUP as being too soft on issues such as Irish language or women's equality and rights. So it's disappointing to see that the potential trajectory of the DUP is to go further right. Some of us would wonder if they could go any further right than they already are. So it's going to be an interesting few months to see what might come from that. It's notable that MLA Jim Wells, the whip was removed from him within the party a few years ago, has now been taken back into the fold. So I think that gives us some indication as to the direction the party might go in.
And do you have hope for the liberal-minded Mr. Potts that he will bring the DUP into the political centre where they can work together with other parties?
Are we talking about the same person?
We are, yes.
Well, look, I have hope for the liberal centre grind of Northern Ireland. And I think that, you know, what we're seeing now is really the outworkings of a party that hasn't come to terms with its position in Northern Ireland at present, and that it is losing the majority support that it once had, and its base is becoming ever smaller. And they're dealing with the outworkings now of the Brexit they campaigned for and the effects that that's having. So really, there's a lot of rhetoric and whataboutery and political maneuvering, trying to sort of absolve themselves of responsibility for what we're now witnessing in terms of the Irish Sea border. If Edwin Putz is the one to take the helm, which it seems he does have majority support at present, you know, this is someone who I wrote an article about a few months ago because he had managed to sectarianize the pandemic by, you know, saying that the Catholics were 6 or 10 times or 100 times more likely or whatever it was to catch COVID than Protestants. So this is someone who believes the earth is only 4,000 years old and the policies that they support are really reminiscent of a very old, outdated, conservative Northern Ireland. And if the intention of the party is to try to go after the more hardline conservative Christian base, which would be closer to more that of the TUV and Jim Allister, there really isn't that substantial a part of Northern Ireland that support that kind of politics. You know, like Jim Allister is one MLA of the TUV and their votes are representative of that base. So I think that if the DUP goes in the direction of Edwin Putz, who also boycotted a North-South Ministerial Council meeting on Friday as well, indicating that might be how he intends to go on, they're going to end up, in my view, losing more of their voters because there's no space now for progressive liberal unionists as to where they're going to place their vote. So I think that we'll see more people shifting to Alliance And I think that despite all of the political outworkings of the party, you know, we do have a substantial majority in Northern Ireland who really just want to get on with life and have moved far past the history that the DUP is trying to take us back to. So I don't think it will go as well as they might hope if they go in that direction.
I think that's a really interesting point. And Donna, I would like to come to you in a second, but I just think you started, Emma, by saying, you know, they haven't addressed the underlying inequality. They haven't addressed the social mobility. There's still access. We've spoken to the commissioner for children, Kula Yesuma, and she's going to kill me for mispronouncing her name. But, you know, in terms of like the thing, the steps that need to be taken, you know, integration is all well and good. Say we need to integrate schools, but we need to integrate communities, and all of these things need to take place. And it does seem that they're doubling down on a strategy that isn't working. It's very much reminds me of the last 24 hours of people since Owen Murphy resigned as Fine Gael former housing minister. People are saying, well, his policies that weren't working for a decade were going to start working, you know, and things were getting gradually worse. And it does remind me of that. If they're going to, you know, let's do more of the thing that wasn't working and see if that can make things better in the long term. Don, you watch, I know you very, you watch Northern Ireland politics with a keen eye. You must have been thinking to yourself, this can't be real.
I mean, I think I did realise it real. It was real. I mean, first of all, it's been very, very funny watching, you know, English journalists who almost never look at Northern Ireland commenting on Northern Irish politics. My favourite was Robert Peston, who said that he thought that if Arlene Foster went and the party went more right wing, then a lot of swing voters would probably move to Sinn Féin from the DUP, which was probably my favourite. I guess my one question for Emma, I mean, I should have looked this up beforehand. I mean, obviously the MLAs were all signing their letter, and that was ultimately what made Arlene fall on her sword. Aside from that, there were also, I think, 85 DUP councillors who were signing a letter that they were going to give to Lord Morrow, asking for both Arlene and Nigel Dodds to go. So, does Emma think that Dodds is safe now and that Arlene fell on her sword to kind of protect him? Or is Dodds still possibly in the ranking for also getting pushed aside?
I think that there is going to still be a bit of a pushback against Dodds and perhaps his wife as well. I've saw some discontent from councillors being voiced in terms of the positions that they currently hold in the party. And he's being seen largely to be responsible for not reining in Arlene, is how it's being phrased. But whether or not in the long term that it will just be Arlene, I'm not sure. I think that her resignation so quickly will probably make it a little bit easier for the other leadership to hold on. I did note that they were calling for a full sweep of the DUP leadership, including advisors and the whole shebang. So we'll see if they're going to gut the whole thing and start anew with the old base, or whether or not any of them will be able to hold on. But I would say the next few weeks are going to be really uncertain in terms of the direction that they're going to go in, and ever changing in terms of who's going to end up being ousted from the party. I mean, we're really seeing them taking the party apart before our eyes, is what we're witnessing. And that could have the ramifications that we could end up having an early Stormont election as well.
I guess Sinn Féin are also going to start tackling the orange wall, so to speak.
I think the best party that's going to be winning here and probably having a party right now is going to be the Alliance Party, having the best week of their lives in terms of what they're going to do. What will be interesting to watch is what direction will the UUP go into? Because obviously the Ulster Unionist Party would be, you know, a more obvious choice for unionists to maybe go to when the DUP goes too far to the right. But the problem is the Ulster Unionist Party has been just so weak over the past decade, really since Mike Nesbitt, I suppose, lost his position. They just have not been doing well at all in terms of having their own identity and their own sense of self. And over the last few months around the Northern Ireland Protocol, they have been going more and more closely aligned with the DUP to a point where it's hard sometimes to really tell the two apart. Mm-hmm. So I think that it would be great to see the UUP try to re-energize what their identity is and try to carve out a place for themselves as a more progressive unionist party. But in terms of whether or not the current leadership in the UUP is capable of doing that, I wouldn't be convinced.
Noel, you're looking up north and you're saying that they have more, as this phrase is now, more freedoms than we have here currently at the moment. Have you any thoughts about the impact of what's going on up north compared to what's going on down here?
Well, I think I'm still getting over the fact that even conversion therapy was actually on the table as something that needed to be voted for or against. I was really struck by that. And I don't profess to know a lot about Northern politics, but Arlene Foster I have been watching with interest. But I just couldn't get over that was the issue. And I just noticed in the chat there someone saying she wasn't homophobic enough. You know what I mean? Those kind of issues are, you know, that would be something that would concern me, but I don't know the ins and outs. And it's fascinating to hear Emma talk about Northern politics and to get an insight. I think sometimes we think we know Northern politics down here, but I don't think we do. I think we're very removed from it in a lot of ways. But I mean, my interest in terms of the commission, the report into mother and baby homes there, I just felt it was a lot more progressive. And also, I think we could learn from that, you know.
I think there's a really interesting point there in terms of it goes back to what a few weeks ago again when we had Brian Smith on, the Green Party councillor, and the first thing he told me was to shove my Free State hot take about what's going on up the north where the sun doesn't shine, and he said it in probably those words as well, but he came from a good place. But I could ask one question, Noel, if you were watching, and Emma, you'll comment. Everybody was the eyes of us down south all looked at people queuing to go back to the shops, to go get their hair cut, to go. I mean, you have this as well, Dawn. You're getting on what's been called a vaccine bonus. And I will push on one little button, Noel, though, that we haven't seen in our own plan. There's not much talk of the arts in there.
Oh, God, no. Theatre is just missing from that agenda. It's extraordinary. And I was talking to somebody the other day about this. You know, it's never mentioned. You know, it'll be sport, it'll be cinema. And the interesting thing about cinema, and a friend of mine said that the other day, people go to the cinema to eat popcorn. And you know what I mean? They're not going to be wearing masks. They're going to be sitting there eating. People go to the theatre and they can't do that. You know what I mean? You're sitting there, you're watching a play or whatever. But the arts has been, you know, I mean, Catherine Martin is doing great work as Minister for the Arts, but it's just not on the table a lot of the time. And I think there's no understanding of, you can't just say, oh, theatres now can open, let's put on some shows. The preparation that goes on beforehand to produce a show, to rehearse the show, to sell tickets, you know, we need to be told, you know, quickly when this is going to happen, as opposed to a last minute knee-jerk reaction. But they mention every aspect of culture, and theatre never seems to be in the agenda. There is a huge theatre-going population in Ireland, all over the country, actually. So it's kind of, I don't know why that is, that theatre just isn't on the agenda.
I'll say what will happen is, the usual thing will happen, as soon as something gets a bit of cultural capital, they'll want pictures. The same politicians that didn't support you will then say, show up to some opening and an event and want a picture beside you, and they will avail of your cultural capital.
Absolutely. And it's a huge amount of money involved in the arts, and there's a huge branding that goes on around the world. But they'll talk about some sports achievement or whatever, film achievement, but theatre is never mentioned. And there's an extraordinary amount of successes and celebration of Irish theatre worldwide that isn't acknowledged a lot of the time.
I'm going to move us from one dysfunctional political system to another. And Dawn, it seems that after a good run of conning everybody, that Johnson is finally coming under some pressure, basically because of his bad taste in furnishings, but also the fact that even though he's coming under such pressure, the Conservatives are doing particularly well in the polls, and Carl Starmer seems to have utterly destroyed the Labour Party.
You'd know Keir Starmer's not doing well when you can't even say his name correctly.
Keir Starmer, he's utterly destroying destroyed the Labour Party. Utterly destroyed it.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, when I think back to the 2017, 2019 general elections, I'd say maybe a good three quarters of my friends were out campaigning for the Labour Party. And now I'd say I know about five people who go out door knocking, the rest of them have either cancelled their direct debits or just ignore every email asking them to go out campaigning. It's incredible. I mean, I think with Boris Johnson, part of the reason why he's still doing so well in the polls is that when it came to the general election, people kind of knew what they were voting for. They knew that he was a bona fide liar. They knew that he was completely dishonest. They knew he was just out for himself and they didn't really care. And what's really interesting about the flat renovations is, so essentially, you know, he looked at his flat and basically every prime minister who comes in is given £30,000 every year to renovate the flat that they live in number 11. And in the small print, it says if you want to, you can combine that money so that you can add it all together. And, you know, looking at the flat I live in, if somebody gave me £30,000 to renovate it, then I have literally no idea how I would manage to spend that much money. But he clearly decided it wasn't enough. You know, his partner, who oddly enough I went to university with, you know, she's well over 20 years younger than him, decided that she wanted to go for a really, really high-end designer who makes kind of migraine-inducing kind of, you know, mixed prints, etc. And Boris Johnson, being Boris Johnson, decided that rather than pay for it for the extra himself, he wanted to try and find a way to get extra money out of it. So he first approached the Conservative Party, asked them if they could possibly give him some money, and they said no. And now, you know, basically every single time questions are asked about how it was funded, you know, his press secretary refuses to give straight answers. There are increasingly contradictory statements coming out, and it looks as though they got an external donor to give money to the Conservative Party, who then gave the money to Boris Johnson, who is now slowly paying it back bit by bit. And it's just kind of very, very typical of Boris Johnson, because he is, you know, despite being incredibly rich and earning a lot of money, he's also very, very tight-fisted. I mean, it's well known that if he takes people out for drinks, he'll insist that they pay for them. There was an article in the Daily Mail today that he was complaining that he was broke despite earning £150,000 a year. He was complaining that whenever he orders food from the Downing Street kitchen, he has to pay for it. It's totted up and it's paid for, you know, every single time he gets a bill every month. And, you know, I'm not sure what living arrangements you and your kind of listeners have, but every time I eat food from my kitchen, I also have to pay for it. And he said that in order to live comfortably, he'd need to earn about £300,000 a year.
He should have become the Taoiseach of Ireland.
Absolutely.
And not the Prime Minister.
100%. I was just coming here. It's so unreal. I mean, when you look at that, but then when you think too, his comment about bodies piling high in the streets, that gets lost in the news cycle, and it's all about this really chintzy bad apartment getting redecorated. How come none of those blows about what he's saying about people who could be left to die in their thousands, that bodies could pile up on the streets? Is there any animosity towards him for those comments?
Bizarrely, no. It's really with Boris Johnson, it's essentially the fact that, you know, people who like him will always like him no matter what he does, and they kind of accept these sorts of things. Whereas the people who, you know, don't vote for him, don't like him, etc., are always very shocked by that. And so the press end up trying to focus on what they can actually prove. So when it comes to the, you know, thousands of bodies piled in high in the street, obviously, you know, thousands of people did die. He did call the lockdown too late, and the wave did happen. So essentially what he shouted about did happen. But it's very, very hard to kind of change the mind of the people who voted for him. You know, there are very, very few voters who thought, actually, I thought this guy was incredibly honest. I thought he was a politician who really cared about the public and would be a great leader. You know, that he's always compared himself to Churchill publicly, but he's always also publicly, you know, given the impression of being a joke figure. So essentially, every time these kind of, you know, controversies come out, he jokes about it, he laughs about it. So it's very rare, such as, you know, in the House of Commons on Wednesday, he got incredibly angry. He was shouting across the dispatch box. He went bright red. And it's very, very rare to actually get him into that position. So it's clear that he's very worried about it. And, you know, when it comes to the bodies piling up comment, you know, journalists can speak to as many sources as they want, but it's very, very difficult to actually get proof that he did say that. And even if he did say that, he'll just come out and say, well, I said it very flippantly, but I did everything I could to try and stop COVID. Whereas when it comes to the flat renovations, it's a lot easier to kind of chase that paper and find out exactly where the money came from and, you know, try and prove that he did do something wrong in public office. So the Electoral Commission are looking into that now. Journalists are still trying to chase down, you know, precisely when it happened. And apparently he began looking into, you know, where to find this money in kind of February and March in 2020. So precisely when the COVID epidemic was beginning, when the first lockdown was happening, and when he caught COVID and ended up in hospital himself after boasting that he had, you know, gone to a COVID ward and shaken hands with loads of patients, which, surprise, surprise, gave him COVID.
He's, I just think there is an element, and you're right, there's an element of he's the affable, you know, everybody's favorite village idiot in a way, but he's not a village idiot. And unfortunately his position is such, but there is a power struggle that's been going on in number 10 and number 11 for since he really took power. Emma, you must sit and watch that and think, you know, they're all talking about this in the UK, and when and where will actually the Northern Ireland Protocol, the Good Friday Agreement, all of these things, it must feel hopeless at some point.
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, so I forever am hopeful. And as you'll all know, I've had my fair share of experience going up against the British government in the past. But I think what Donna said here is very accurate. You know, like Boris Johnson's base is similar to that of Trump's base. He can say and do whatever he likes and people are not going to change their minds as to supporting him, which is pointing to a whole other conversation in terms of societal attitudes to politics. But in terms of the government we have now, the Conservative government, it is quite a dangerous government in terms of a lot of the policies they're bringing forward. I think in particular towards the immigration policies that they're coming forward with at the moment are really concerning. And then also a lot of the laws they're trying to bring forward in terms of around free speech and the right to protest. And then when it comes to Northern Ireland, this is a government that is completely disengaged with Northern Irish politics, completely disengaged, and have very little regard for the Good Friday Agreement. You know, through all of my campaigning, I would often hear through the Brexit process them say that they were fully committed to the Good Friday Agreement, whilst at the same time they were simultaneously taking strands of the Good Friday Agreement through the court in our case. So it really is all bluff and words, but very little commitment to Northern Ireland. And then with the Northern Irish Protocol, I mean, we know that it forms part of British law. It has been brought through Parliament. It has to be implemented in full. Of course, there needs to be some leniency and creative thinking and trying to find practical ways to alleviate concerns within the unionist population in the north. And there isn't really an appetite, it seems, from Westminster to try and find creative solutions, because there is that lack of engagement and interest in what's happening on the ground. So really, in terms of our position, and I think that's part of the reason why there is such concern with the unionist communities, is they see that. They see that lack of engagement, lack of interest. And, you know, it's something that many have known for a long time, but it's becoming quite sharp in its focus now that we're going through the full Brexit process.
Before we move on, I'm just going to say to people, look, if you have any questions, any comments you want to make, raise your hands and we'll come back to you as soon as we're finished on the main part. And before we do that, Tony, I'd like to come to you for a little bit of a news wrap on the week. Could you give us just...
Dave, what a week. What a week. I mean, we had Owen Murphy's resignation was again triggering a by-election in Dublin Bay South. And the media have huge interest there, because predominantly that's where a lot of our middle-class media operate in Dublin Bay South. So, you know, there, I saw an article say this will be a barometer for the electorate. I don't think so. I don't think so. It seems to be pretty middle-class. And I think I did make a flippant remark, and a journalist sent me a DM saying that it wasn't really nice that I said that if Fine Gael ran a green bin with a Fine Gael logo on it and called it Leinstertainment, it would top the poll. So I kind of hold out hope that there might be a battle there in terms of what's going on, because we see even Fine Gael, it looks like they're gonna go with Young Egan above Kate O'Connell, and it means that therefore Kate O'Connell stays on the bench.
She stays in the cold, Tony. Yeah. She's out in the cold very much so.
Just keep. I want to lash through this, Martin. There's a couple of things coming this week in the Dáil from both Keane O'Callaghan and the Sock Dems and Eoin O'Brien and Sinn Féin looking at protecting renters and giving renters a break. Be interesting to see if there's some sort of cross-party support amongst the left or the broad left, and to see if people can get behind that. Nice to see if we could see something, the sparks of the beginning of something like that. Another thing that was really, I've been saying it for months, and we've had the guys on from the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. Ireland has been told several times now that you are one of the key chains in the global tax abuse that's going on. One of eight countries that make up over 85% of global tax avoidance. This week, Joe Biden has fingered Ireland out as a key role, and they need, and what has to change. And apparently, the EU are looking at linking COVID, rebuilding out of it and coming out of COVID to Ireland doing something about how this is happening. This is a huge threat to us. Like, it's billions of euro to the exchequer. The Taoiseach said this week that Ireland doesn't have gas or oil or diamonds. He actually made that statement and talked about natural resources. Martin, I always maintain Ireland's natural resources. We have effectively financial waven pipes that allow all this money to pass through, and we charge a service fee, whether you like it or lump it, that's what we do. And if it goes away overnight, we could be in a serious black hole. And then the last thing I want to say is, how lucky have Sinn Féin been this week?
Yeah, they have.
You have a councillor, former councillor, I should say, charged with murder in the Regency Hotel, and Owen Murphy resigns and no one pays any attention. And then you have the entire Derry Ard Carla being asked to step down, and Arlene Foster goes, and no one is paying any attention. I mean, you couldn't make it up. They have missed every opportunity to land a blow on them. Mary Lou McDonald was celebrating her birthday yesterday. She must have had the biggest of grins thinking that week went on and no one even laid a glove. Oh, and I should have said one last thing. National Marine Planning Framework went to the floor in the Dáil, 50 minutes of debate as such, but it's going to go to a vote. So if you haven't already let your TDs know, please let your TDs know that it's something we should all be pushing back on. It needs scrutiny from people who actually know what they're talking about, and not just be guillotined through at this next stage.
And if I could, and I'm just going to interject that we have a podcast coming up during the week, and it promises to be really rambunctious. It's myself and Brandon Ogle, and Tony is hosting with Mick Clifford. So it promises to be rambunctious. And I'm sorry there's no women on this one, but this is a down and dirty fight, and it will be a great podcast, an absolutely great podcast.
You just want to fight with Brandon Ogle.
Always.
I think we might leave it there for this part, Martin.
Yeah, I think so. Anybody who has any questions or comments, please raise your hand. Tony will come to you now in a minute. And I'd just like to remind everybody, the Tortoise Shack does all of these podcasts, all of these live shows, and the Sunday show is by far one of the most popular shows we have. A lot of people listen to this show. So thank you for coming along and listening. The address again for patrons is patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Tony, back to you, buddy.